market rate, £3,000 a day. Were you signing Lionel Messi?
This is First Minister's Questions. Just once, it would be nice to get a First Minister's answer.
For Douglas Ross to stand there and talk about losing grip of a party when he has been leader, the Conservatives have had the longest attempted coup in Scottish political history.
The Steamy, a laudable production for The Scotsman.
Hello and welcome to The Steamy, The Scotsman's politics podcast. I'm Alistair Grant, The Scotsman's political editor, and I'm joined today, as always, by Rachel Amory, our political correspondent, and live from London, Alexander Brown, The Scotsman's Westminster correspondent. And for the first time, David Ball, who is The Scotsman's new deputy political editor. David, how's it going? Welcome to The Steamy.
Great, glad to be here.
That's the kind of enthusiasm we need in The Steamy. Later on, we'll have an interview that Alex did with the SNP MP and Scotsman columnist, Stuart MacDonald, as he came back from a visit to Ukraine. But just before that, the other big news has obviously been Chancellor Jeremy Hunt setting out his spring budget in Westminster following days of fevered speculation over what it might contain. In the end, there were few surprises and no rabbits out the hat, to use that annoying phrase that journalists and politicians love in the run-up to a budget. Mr Hunt confirmed a further 2p cut to the national insurance rate, benefiting 2.4 million workers across Scotland. But there was bad news for the Scottish Conservatives as the Chancellor announced an extension of the windfall tax on oil and gas companies. Douglas Ross, the Scottish Conservative leader, was quite quick to make his disappointment over this clear, writing on X that he was deeply disappointed by the decision. It's hugely embarrassing for the Scottish Conservatives, who have been vocally opposed to Labour's plans to extend and increase the windfall tax. And the Tories are obviously hoping to hold on to their seats in the North East, partly by championing the oil and gas sector. Journalists caught up with Douglas Ross just after First Minister's Questions in Holyrood today to ask him about the extension and his reaction to it.
Douglas Ross, why does the Scottish oil and gas industry have to be the budget losers?
So I was very clear to the Chancellor of the Exchequer, the Prime Minister, to senior members of the government that it was the wrong choice to extend the windfall tax on oil and gas companies. I made that clear throughout the last week. I put that case across as robustly as I could, and I have been clear to every single one of you that I still believe the Chancellor is wrong. And that's why I have made the firm commitment and the guarantee that I will oppose the bill that will be required in Westminster to introduce that extension, because I do not support it in any way.
Why has he not listened to you?
Well, I reiterate that the Chancellor has got that wrong. You know, I made that point to him personally, and I said in no uncertain terms I wouldn't go out and try and either shy away from making comment on it or suddenly come round and support him. He has made the wrong choice here, and I made that position very clear.
And did you threaten to quit?
No, no. Look, we had strong, robust discussions. But ultimately, the best way I can stop this happening is being in the House of Commons and opposing the legislation that the government will need to bring forward. Because, of course, that legislation is required because the government themselves inserted a sunset clause to provide a guarantee and security that the windfall tax would come to an end, and they have not provided that security any longer, and that's why I oppose it.
But there's no doubt this is embarrassing, and it puts your position really in a tricky point.
Look, I know that's how some opponents want to frame it, and indeed some people wrote a column on it yesterday, which I read with great interest, Tom. But, you know, I think we're in this sad situation that, you know, it's almost too prescribed and politicians only ask for things they think they're going to get. I knew this was going to be a really tough fight. When we started to hear reports of this, then I knew it was probably odds on it was going to happen. But I wasn't going to leave anything on the field. I wasn't going to, not go in and fully support the industry that I think are right to say this is the wrong approach to take. If ultimately others think I should have shied away or not said anything publicly, then I don't think the industry and the sector in the northeast of Scotland would have been able to see that I was standing up for them as strongly as
but
I could.
But you were still ignored.
Well, no, the Chancellor had a difficult budget to set, and I think everyone's accepted that, and there's a balance to be struck. There are things I'm very happy with in the budget. You know, I made that very clear yesterday. I think an income tax for people across the United Kingdom and 2.4 Scots is positive. So there are things in the budget that I support, there are this issue that I don't. But I'm not, and I never will, shy away from publicly saying that this is the wrong choice by the Chancellor, and I still have an opportunity to prevent it happening when that bill has come back to Parliament.
Does this not show that the Scottish Conservatives cannot stand up for the North East, or they can't even convince their own party?
No, look, this is an issue, and I think the Chancellor also name-checked me in other issues within the budget that, you know, where he could, he was able to meet the requests that we had as Scottish Conservatives, and I'm very grateful that there has been another duty freeze on Scotch whisky. I'm grateful that the duty on fuel has been frozen again, particularly for car drivers and vehicle users in the north of Scotland. But it's a balancing act, and he has come down to the final decisions, but he was left in no doubt, the Prime Minister was left in no doubt, senior members of the government were left in no doubt, my opposition to the plans to extend the windfall tax, and that opposition remains, and it will remain when I'm voting against the bill.
That was Douglas Ross, the Scottish Conservative leader, just as he was exiting the Holyrood chamber after First Minister's questions. And I think you can really hear the frustration in his voice there. Rachel, has this decision left Douglas Ross and the Scottish Conservatives humiliated?
Well, I'm not sure humiliated, but certainly a bit salty, if nothing else, because as you were saying, you and I were both at the party conference last weekend in Aberdeen, where Douglas Ross was, you know, very clear saying, I don't want an extension to the windfall tax. This is not what the offshore industry wants. This is not what the industry has told me they want. And he also said that he'd personally spoken to Chancellor Jeremy Hunt as well, explaining that this shouldn't be done either. So for him to have, you know, personally made interventions there with the Chancellor and been very publicly clear on what he wants with journalists in Scotland, to then have this in the chamber is not going to be great for him at all. He was name-checked by the Chancellor on a few other budget matters, for example, the alcohol duty freeze. When it comes to windfall tax, though, it is quite embarrassing for them. And it's left Douglas Ross in a very sort of awkward situation now. But what does he do now? Does he go with what the government's saying, or does he stick to his word?
And David, how electorally damaging do you think it will be for the Scottish Conservatives? Do you think this will damage their prospects ahead of that general election?
Yeah, I think up in Scotland it could be potentially very damaging. The Scottish Conservatives are very much on the defensive. They're trying to just hang on to their seats. The polling across the UK is not looking very rosy for them. And oil and gas is just the issue in the northeast of Scotland, where they're basically going toe-to-toe with the SNP. Both parties have been scrapping over this for the last few months, pointing the finger at Labour for their own sort of windfall tax plans that are perceived to be doing even more damage to the industry. So it potentially, as well as being a huge dent to Douglas Ross's leadership and his authority in Scotland, it has the potential to do a lot of harm to their chance at the general election.
And Alex, it wasn't just Douglas Ross who was speaking out about this. Andrew Bowie, the junior energy minister, also a North East MP, made his disappointment clear as well on X, formerly known as Twitter, obviously. Is he now on resignation watch? Do you think it's likely that he would resign over this? And what is the kind of atmosphere among those Scottish Tory MPs in Westminster?
I mean, that's a bit like rabbits in the hat resignation watch. It's another proper journalism term, but he's very much on resignation watch. I would say the mood among the Scottish Tories is one of outright despair and anger. I spoke to one who said to me that basically things have got better under Rishi Sunak. After the previous two prime ministers, they'd had a bad relationship and they didn't feel they got Scotland. But it seemed like Rishi Sunak was trying to work with them. And then this is another example of pulling the rug out from them completely and leaving them having to defend a policy or support one that they'd been completely against in the first place. And it speaks to a pattern, really, of behaviour from the UK government. I mean, we mentioned the spirit freeze, which he was being congratulated on and mentioned in the speech. I think it's worth mentioning that he was only referenced there to kind of make it look like everything was good, because the Scottish Tories didn't want the duty freeze and the duties to be raised in the first place. It was raised last year, and the Scotch Whisky Association and other industry bodies have been desperately calling for a cut. Instead, the government froze it. It's still four times higher than cider. That's not progress. And it raises questions about what, say, the Scottish Tories actually have over the manifesto and what, say, they have about government policy. I was in a briefing with Alistair Jack after the spring budget, and I asked him about this. And I said, you know, do you have any say? And he was very defensive, didn't really answer. But he instead said that, you know, the SNP and Labour have changed their position on this, but we've been really consistent in supporting the oil and gas. I was the only person to stand up during COP26 and defend oil and gas. And he may well have done that, but that doesn't really mean anything if you're legislating to make their lives harder. There seems to be a disconnect between the Scottish Tories and the UK government once again, which just consistently undermines Douglas Ross. It's a disaster for the Scottish Tories. It's an absolute disaster.
Yeah, and obviously we say that Andrew Bowie is on resignation watch, but I mean, how likely is it that he will actually resign over this? Because I mean, I suppose the perception up here is that he probably won't, although he can't even, I suppose, abstain really, because he is an energy minister. So he basically has to decide whether he's going to vote for this policy, you know, this separate legislation for the windfall tax extension, and just kind of swallow his pride, essentially, or whether he's going to take a stand and actually, you know, resign or force Downing Street to sack him.
I mean, he's in an absolutely awful position. And I think it's worth remembering that he's had his brief kind of changed already because the government were doing something, I think it was involving pylons in his constituency, that was a conflict of interest that he wouldn't have supported. So he had to be quietly shuffled out of it. He has been in the in government roles consistently throughout his time in politics. And throughout those, I feel like he's been forced to agree and defend things which he does not support whatsoever. So I suppose his thinking and speaking to those around him will probably be, can I stop it with Douglas Ross before it gets to that stage? They've already said they'll work together. Can a deal be reached for him not to be there? I mean, we know that's a thing that MPs do. That would allow him to maintain his role. I mean, we saw Boris Johnson, I think, go to a conference on the other side of the world to avoid voting for a Heathrow extension. Could he do something similar? There's no way that he can U-turn on this and say he supports it. It is impossible for him to vote for it. So he either has to make an excuse to not be at the vote, which MPs do all the time, or he needs to find a way to kind of, I suppose, quit, really. I wouldn't expect him to quit. I think there'll have to be some sort of workaround. And I think it's worth noting that at the time of recording, the government, the Prime Minister's official spokesperson said, I've got full confidence in him and they understand his concerns. I mean, not enough to address the concerns, but they understand them.
And Rachel, you were touching on the fact that we were obviously up in Aberdeen at the weekend for the Scottish Conservative Conference. And they had this kind of repeated message about standing up for the North East, being the only party that's, you know, full behind the North Sea energy sector. It was something that came up time and time again in pretty much every single speech to that conference. Can they credibly still say that they are the party, you know, standing up for North Sea oil and gas when they are extending the windfall tax, a policy that, you know, up until a couple of days ago, really now, they were saying would be hugely damaging to the sector and potentially cost tens of thousands of jobs?
I think we're going to have to see what happens over the next few days, aren't we? It was a very strategic move to hold the conference in Aberdeen to try and have that focus on oil and gas. When we were there, there's a lot of focus on it, a lot of sort of fringe events on it. I think Offshore Energies UK had a big reception at the conference as well. And it was a big talking point in many of the speeches that were made as well. And as you said, it's one of the few pockets in Scotland where the Scottish Conservatives do still have a lot of popularity. They may still do very well in the next general election in the North East, where they won't in the rest of the country. It does depend on what happens over the next few days here and how those particular MPs, like David Jukett, for example, how do they play it and how does Andrew Bowie play it, for example. That's all going to matter now too. But I think it also got to think about, we're all thinking about the big oil and gas giants here, the people who work in the industry here. There are, of course, lots of people in the North East who are struggling with their energy bills who probably will be quite welcoming of a windfall tax extension. Albeit everyone in Aberdeen does know somebody who works in the offshore oil industry. You can't move in Aberdeen without being bombarded by how dominant that industry is in the area. But there will, of course, be people who are struggling with their bills, just like everyone else in the country up there.
No, I think that's a very good point, and I would be interested to see actually some polling on how much people in the North East actually take this into consideration when they're casting their vote in, you know, a general election. I'm not saying it wouldn't be a consideration. I mean, clearly all three main political parties, Labour, the SNP and the Tories, think it is, because they're now fighting like rats in a sack over this and very keen to have their say on it. So they clearly think that this is a really important issue in terms of how voters, you know, cast their vote in the North East. But I'd really like to see some kind of evidence as to how much actually sways people's vote. And on that issue, David, you know, are you surprised that this has become such a big issue? Because it's something that I feel like, you know, we've been talking about a lot in recent weeks. We obviously had a speech from Humza Yousaf up in Aberdeen just a couple of weeks ago, I think it was, where he was laying into Labour's plans to extend and increase the windfall tax. it really feels like, you know, coming into the general election, this will be a topic that, you know, just won't go away. It'll continue to grab the headlines.
Yeah, it feels like we haven't got into the ins and outs of the general election yet, but it really does feel like this is the only issue that people are talking about in Scotland, is the oil and gas sector. Labour are in a quite interesting position because they're not really chasing votes realistically in the North East. It's very much a fight between the SNP and the Tories. So Labour are probably appealing to a different sort of demographic with their sort of pitch about the windfall tax, more to the wider public about some of the climate aspects to it, which has maybe allowed them to be a bit more harder in their stance against the industry, and maybe why to them it's worth the risk. But the SNP have been criticised heavily by the Tories throughout this parliament, since the election and before, under Nicola Sturgeon, about not standing up for the oil and gas workers. And they've now chosen this as the horse to back, that they are the only party that is looking after them. And especially with this sort of disastrous position for the Scottish Tories, it just plays straight into their hands and has given them a complete open goal, really.
Away from Holyrood and Westminster, the world recently marked 2 years of 2 years since the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Alex spoke to SNP MP and Scotsman columnist Stuart MacDonald as he returned from a visit to Ukraine. They touched on Stuart's experiences there, some of the harrowing sights he saw, and what locals told him.
I'm once again joined by Stuart MacDonald, who's back from Ukraine.
Yes.
How was your trip? I don't imagine it was particularly joyful.
Well, it was eye-opening and it was useful, which, you're right, you don't go to these things and come back feeling warm. I've come back feeling determined. There's kind of two strands to the visit. There's the kind of political strand, and then there's the second strand, which is more about the reality on the ground. And both are connected. So there's a series of meetings with Ukrainian politicians, members of the government, members of the opposition, people like the Prosecutor General. There was also a conference on whilst we were there, the Yalta European Strategy Conference, which brings together people who support Ukraine from around the world and who work in politics, academia, their think tanks, they're from the defence industry, they're from, you know, various walks of life who give their own analysis of the conflict and where it's going, and crucially how best we can help. And then there's the reality on the ground side of it. So I spent some time with the Halo Trust, which is Scotland's largest NGO, is doing a huge effort to demine parts of Ukraine. I spent some time with them in Chernihiv, which is in the north of Ukraine, in positions where Russian soldiers initially came in from Belarus. Chernihiv is called the Shield of Ukraine because it's that region that stopped Kyiv being taken ultimately. And Russian soldiers just riddled that part in mines before they left. Mines, tripwires, butterfly mines, all these things. Spent some time in Chernihiv with local government officials and locals themselves, saw enormous bits of destruction to civilian infrastructure, things like a theatre, a youth centre, apartment buildings, a hospital. And then the one bit that will stay with me forever was the visit to a small village in Chernihiv called Yakhidne. Tiny village, only a few hundred people. Some of your listeners might remember from the start of the conflict, is where Russian soldiers rounded up all the residents, so over 300 people, and held them against their will in a basement for 27 days. No food. They were given very tiny portions of food to share. No medicines. The youngest person held was about 6 weeks old. The oldest person held was about 93. And some of the people who were actually held there took us down into that basement, and it's probably the most harrowing thing I've ever had to listen to. So it's been useful in terms of understanding the political context of where things are at 2 years on from the full invasion, 10 years on from the initial invasion, but also hearing from civilians themselves and what that impact is. But the big thing I've come back with, and this is what I mean when I talk about being determined, the big thing I've come back with is that for all of the chest beating we do on how much we're helping Ukraine, we are nowhere near helping them enough on military and weapons support. Nowhere near. They are short of ammunition, they are short of shells, to the point where this is costing them territory and lives. And we need to be upping that along with other European countries. The US aid not coming through is being felt enormously. So I'm deeply, deeply worried. The sense of anxiety I picked up when I was there is like nothing I've experienced in my many, many visits previously.
Well, that's something I think I'd like to pick up on, because obviously a lot of people know about the war in Ukraine. It's kind of separate to them. They'd see it in the newspapers, they see statistics, but they didn't really understand the real impact on people. You're obviously speaking to civilians and Ukrainians there. What do they say to you? I mean, what is their mood like? Because I suppose here people worry, like, are they going to be able to win? Are they going to lose to Russia? What are people talking about when you meet them?
Exactly that. They're worried about losing to Russia.
And has that fear grown? Because I know that you've been going for a couple of years. Has that mood changed?
Yes. I mean, you can see it in the retreat most recently from Avdiivka. Now, Avdiivka has been on the front line of this war for 10 years. Avdiivka was the first part of eastern Ukraine I visited, along with Kramatorsk, Slovyansk. You know, Kramatorsk might even be next to fall. And I spoke to veterans. I went to a veterans recovery centre, spoke to veterans there about their experiences of the war, spoke to serving members of the military, heard from at the conference I was at, serving member of the armed forces was kind of beamed in by video link to talk to us about what was going on. And them not getting the weapons fast enough is what's costing lives and costing territory. And the sense of worry about losing is growing exponentially because of delays, not just in the US funding package, but even a slow yes is what they refer to it as. So even when countries are saying, yep, we're going to give you A, B, and C capability, it's incredibly slow, first of all, to get them to agree to that, and then secondly, to actually provide the capability. So if you take F-16s, which were the fighter jets Ukrainians had been asking for months on end, eventually we get a yes. Then you have to have the training for the pilots, which also takes a long time. The first F-16s probably won't be in Ukraine until the summer of this year. And they're only getting, I think the exact number is around about 20 of them. Why are they only getting about 20 of them? So even when they get a yes, it's a slow yes. And we're seeing this debate happen now with Germany and the Taurus missiles. Germany doing what it has done so many times, saying no to a specific part of capability. They did it on Leopard tanks. Then eventually saying yes. Are we just going through the same again? I met with some of the guys working in drone manufacturing. You know, their drone manufacturing capability just can't compete with the Russians. They're being armed by the Chinese. North Korea is providing them with shells and ammunition at a rate that we just can't compete with. You know, Ukraine is being outstripped in terms of drone technology production massively by the Russians. And that is costing lives. And what that leads to is this sense of anxiety. You know, when I was there in the first year of the invasion, there was a sense of optimism because Ukraine hadn't fallen within weeks, Kyiv hadn't been taken, counter-offensives in places like Kharkiv had been enormously successful. There was a sense of the underdog pushing back, the Russians doing nowhere near as well as what they had thought or what people hoped. I think a lot of that optimism was slightly overplaced now that I look back at it. There is now a deep sense of pessimism. And we have to understand that we've got skin in the game here. We might not have troops in the ground, but this war doesn't end in Ukraine if Russia wins. So we need to massively up our own defence production, massively up the rate at which we provide capability to Ukraine, and give Ukraine what it needs swiftly to try and turn this around. They're not asking us to fight this fight for them, but they do need us to give them the weapons, the technology, the intelligence to help them fight it and win it on their territory.
I suppose a lot of people will think, okay, well, this is the US, right? It's being held up by Republicans in America. And we hear, at least from our leaders here, you know, Boris Johnson was a huge supporter of Ukraine, at least in his in his tone, as has been Rishi Sunak. He released a statement on the anniversary. Is there more that the UK government should be doing? Are there areas where they are being slow or they are refusing to provide things quick enough? Or is it more they need to lead and rally other European nations to support at the same level?
I think definitely we need to go faster in what we're providing. We need to create new opportunities to support Ukraine. One area would be in drone technology, research and development, and the capability of drone technology. We absolutely need to get the weapons there faster. But again, if you look at, so the US package is fundamental. Without it, forget it, right? And we need that to come through. And Zelensky himself has said at the weekend he needs that to come through in the next couple of weeks. But even on the European front, you know, finally yesterday there was the meeting in Paris hosted by President Macron. Finally, France has dropped its opposition to procuring artillery and shells outside of Europe. You know, Germany was always fine with that. France, I think Greece and Cyprus did not want it to happen outside of Europe. The Ukrainians don't give a damn whether it happens inside of Europe or not. They just need the artillery, they need the shells, they need the ammunition, and they need it fast, rather than us having these debates over where it's procured from. But we need to get our defence industry onto effectively a war production footing. That involves the Scottish defence industry. You know, it needs to be in a position not just to provide capability and provide it quickly, but to upscale as well. And I think we need to ourselves look for and create opportunities that allow that to happen, whether that's supporting the defence sector in new contracts, supporting them in areas like new apprenticeships, allowing them to deal with labour shortages that the sector has suffered from. There are a whole range of ways we could do that and get quite creative with it. But it starts with us understanding that we do have skin in the game. And at the minute, that skin in the game is about providing weapons support, intelligence support, and that kind of capability. It's not about sending our own troops. But if we don't win this war in Ukraine, then that war will spill out of Ukraine if Russia is allowed to win. And I think I would characterise the support that the UK, Europe and the wider West is giving at the minute, we're giving Ukraine just enough so that they don't lose. But Russia is certainly making tactical wins on the battlefield. Now, don't get me wrong, that's coming at enormous cost to Russia, not just in terms of what it's spending, but when you look at the death toll on the Russian side, it's absolutely enormous. The Russians don't care. They're happy just to feed the meat grinder as long as they're able to make these types of advances. But we need to shift our thinking and give Ukraine enough and more, not just so that it doesn't lose, but so that it can actively win and make advances to defend its sovereignty.
I suppose finally, obviously, because I can hear how affected you are and how passionate you are about this. And I know that you've been before, but I was wondering, you know, you see these horrible things happening, you hear all these horrible stories from Ukrainians, these fears, and then you get on the train, come home. I was just wondering, because the politics is the personal, Can you talk about what it was like on that train home? Like, can you just switch off and do you start thinking, oh, what am I going to have for tea when I get home? Or is it something that's lingered since you've arrived and got back?
Well, Alex, I was on the train when I texted you to see if we could have this conversation. You know, I think I just got on the overnight train when I texted you, and we'd just departed the station because when I stood in that basement, I mean, just imagine it for a minute, right? Over 300 people held in this small room for 27 days. No sanitation. So we all had to just, you know, do the toilet where they were. They were given tiny cups of food to share between two people once a day. Kids weren't even allowed out. There were over 60 children weren't allowed out to play and get fresh air. Russian soldiers would get drunk and come down and harass them. 7 people would be executed. 10 people would die because of how terrible the conditions were and the impact it had on their health. Corpses just left there. People would have to pick the corpses up and pass them over each other's heads to move them into one side of the room, and it would be 2 meters away from where children were sleeping. So I stood in the basement with some of the people who were themselves held in the basement of that school for 27 days. And I did a thread about this on Twitter, X. You can go and see the pictures. And in that basement, it's a small basement, over 300 people are held, 60 of them children. 7 people would be executed. I saw their names written on the wall with calendar on the wall showing the dates that they had died, there were still children's toys there. They're held there with minimal food, no medicine, no sanitation, nowhere to do the toilet for 27 days. In what can only be described as a kind of medieval, barbaric form of imprisonment and torture. And I asked these women that what they wanted me to do when I left their village, and they pleaded with me to tell people about what had happened, but keep supporting Ukraine, give them what they need in order to maintain their freedom, their dignity, and their sovereignty.
Okay, thank you so much for your time.
That was Alex speaking to the SNP MP Stuart MacDonald as he returned from a visit to Ukraine. And thanks very much for listening. That's all we've got time for this week, but please tune in again next week when we'll have all the latest from the world of Scottish politics. Thanks very much.